Case number 11-5300, Ronnie Payne, appellant versus Patricia Stansberry, warden. Ms. Taramina for the appellant, Mr. Gnez for the appellee.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court. Rosanna Taramina for petitioner, Mr. Ronnie Payne. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. In light of the claims for which this court has granted a certificate of appealability, we believe that Mr. Payne is entitled to reversal and immediate habeas relief on his ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claim under Strickland v. Washington, or at a minimum, a remand for further proceedings in the district court on his conflict of interest claim, which is also an ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claim under Kyler v. Sullivan. Because Mr. Payne can demonstrate both deficient performance and prejudice under Strickland without need for any further proceedings, however, we believe that the Strickland claim is the most direct avenue for relief at this point. Taking the prejudice prong of the Strickland analysis first, Mr. Payne
I'm sorry to derail your order, but I, can we go in the opposite order in the way that it was briefed?
Yes.
And on the Kyler question, is the upshot of your argument that any time there's a claim that could have been made, but as to which trial counsel failed to make an objection, the defendant gets an evidentiary hearing to determine whether the reason the claim wasn't raised on appeal is because trial counsel was worried about laying bare for everybody that he or she failed to make an objection?
If there is an if the petitioner can demonstrate that there is an actual conflict, so there's conflicting interests, and there may not be. Here there was, because there was a possibility that this claim could have been raised under plain error.
No, but how are you ever going to have a situation in which there isn't an actual conflict, or at least enough of a possibility of an actual conflict that you get an evidentiary hearing, where all you know is that there was a claim that could have been, an objection that could have been made at trial, but that wasn't, that could in turn have led to an argument on appeal, and that argument was not made? It seems like in every one of those situations, the defendant can always say, well, the reason counsel didn't make it on appeal is because they didn't object at trial, and they didn't want to lay bare their inadequacy in failing to raise an objection.
Sure, Your Honor. I think that what would insulate the court from having to grant an evidentiary hearing in every one of those situations is actually the legal legitimacy of the claim that would be brought. So,
no, but even here, you're talking about a remand.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the point of the question is, if you make the allegation that appellate counsel, because he was trial counsel, failed to raise an issue on appeal, therefore there should be an evidentiary hearing.
Well, there's two prongs to the Kyler analysis. The first is the conflict, the actual conflict. The second is the adverse impact. And I think that what insulates the court from this problem that I think that you're identifying is this adverse impact prong. And it did insulate the court in the Bruce case, where the court...
Why isn't the... Why isn't the adverse impact every time that the claim wasn't raised on appeal? That's what you're saying here.
The nature and the strength of the claim. It has to be a legitimate
claim.
So
where is the strength of the... This is what I'm not understanding.
Sure.
Where does the strength of the claim fit into your analysis? Because one way to do the strength of the claim is to do strength of prejudice.
I think
But you don't want us to do that.
No. The way that this court had analyzed the issue in Taylor, that Taylor was the case where there was a conflict of interest in the plea proceedings, where the defendant may have had an advice of counsel defense. And because that was a legitimate defense, that was the quote from Taylor is, if an attorney fails to make a legitimate argument because of the attorney's conflicting interest, then the Kyler standard has been met. That's what Taylor says. Now, the proceeding case
now, Taylor
that preceded
also,
that...
Taylor also did Strickland prejudice. I mean, there's a statement in Taylor where the court says that the plea, there's a reasonable probability that the plea would not have been entered into had the advice of counsel defendants been known, citing Hill.
That is true, but I think Taylor also recognized that even if the plea was a valid plea or a good plea or a good deal, that didn't insulate this analysis, that there still could have been this conflict of interest that infected this situation.
My concern with your
reliance on these factors, the actual conflict and effect on the case, is that that's presumably what the evidentiary hearing is going to be about. And don't we need something in this context, when you're just talking about a claim not being raised on appeal, that sifts out which cases get evidentiary hearings and which don't? So we need a predicate inquiry, because, and I know this is the wrong adjective, but the other cases where we've seen this involve, what I must call structural, I know that's the wrong adjective in this context, but you know, you can look and see a lawyer defending two people that have conflicting interests, or a defense on the table that by its very terms implicates the lawyer, like advice of consent. But when all the claim is something wasn't raised on appeal, which routinely happens, we have to have some way to sift out up front what's strategic and what really is a sufficiently serious concern about conflict of interest that it merits this evidentiary hearing. Otherwise, we're going to be having evidentiary hearings in every case.
But I think in most cases, the evidentiary hearing would be conducted on the first prong, on the whether or not there was an actual conflict that caused the adverse impact. But at the very least in this case, we're analyzing...
I guess I don't know what you mean by that. And so they're going to say, in every case where an issue wasn't raised on appeal, it could have been, you're going to have a hearing on whether they raised that because they didn't raise it because it made no strategic sense, or they didn't raise it because, I'm assuming, an error that wasn't identified below, so you have your plain error conflict.
Not if it's a legitimate, if it's not a legitimate argument. So this
okay,
court...
So what is a legitimate argument? That's your sifting.
That's the standard that is set forth in Taylor. In fact, and...
What does that mean? Legitimate argument? Is it Rule 11?
No, I don't. I believe it's something that is below prejudice. It's something that's higher than the Anders standard. It's not non-frivolous. And so I'll say that...
Why I get legitimacy as kind of this intermediate zone. Why not just make it Strickland prejudice? I mean, it seems to me we do need some kind of filter. And this case has been litigated on the assumption that any time you have a conflict of interest, that necessarily means Strickland prejudice is out of the equation, and you get to go forward on the assumption, basically, that there was prejudice. And the problem with that is that, as I understand the Supreme Court's decision in Mickens and our decisions following up on that, it's not clear that just because it's a conflict of interest case, you necessarily avoid Strickland prejudice. That's true in some situations. We know that's true in the context of Kyler. We don't know that's true in other situations. And here, and I'm sorry for the long-winded question, but here, what's different is it's unlike other situations in where you can't really assess what the effect of the conflict was. A lot of times you just don't know what all could have happened at trial had the individual had a conflict-free representative. Here you know exactly what the consequence is, which is that this argument would have been raised. It would have been raised on appeal. And the easy way to deal with that is just to say, well, let's ask whether there's a reasonable probability that that argument would have succeeded.
I think that, I mean, there's other circuits. The First, Second, and Third Circuits have instead of this legitimate argument, and again, something more than Anders, less than Strickland prejudice, the First, Second, and Third Circuits say that if the defendant can demonstrate some plausible alternative defense strategy or tactic that might have been pursued. I think that this would certainly be up to the court, but the harm...
Who identifies the plausible?
The First, Second, and Third Circuits have adopted the standard for what a adverse effect would be. In order to identify an adverse effect, they say that the defendant must demonstrate that some plausible alternative defense strategy or tactic might have been pursued. And
again,
that
it just seems like in every, you know, there's going to be an awful lot of cases. And we see a lot of criminal cases, and it's not at all uncommon to see plain error allegations made. I think were there not plain error claims asserted in this case?
No, there weren't. And that I addressed in their reply. They actually weren't asserted in the appeal. The way that the D.C. Court of Appeals interpreted the argument, they interpreted it as an argument that had not been preserved. But if you go back and look at the way that it was briefed on appeal, first of all, the attorney briefed it as if it was an issue that didn't need to be preserved under Rule 605 in the Superior Court. And he also at least alleged that he had preserved. So as far as he was concerned, he had preserved it. So in that case, we have that issue.
I assume we can all agree that it is not uncommon to see plain error claims asserted.
Well, if there are.
But it doesn't mean all of them, everything that could have been asserted that wasn't preserved.
But you are right, Judge, if the attorney in this case had identified a plain error and had argued plain error, our claim would be much, much weaker because then we can't show that there were conflicting interests
in
that.
The nature of the problem here is, again, is that the asserted conflict, we can't look at it and go, wow, eyebrows should have gone up immediately, alarm bells should have gone off, just like you can when someone's representing two defendants with competing interests, or there's an advice of defense where they themselves, you know, their advice is the issue. It's almost like they're a witness in the case. Those situations, you can just look at them objectively. But what we're asserting here that is going to be the key to evidentiary hearings, is going to open the door, is the type of routine decision-making that lawyers make all the time for ordinarily and perfectly legitimate strategic reasons. And simply saying, well, did they have a legitimate claim? I've done appeals. There's lots of legitimate claims that end up on the cutting room floor because you have to pick your three best or something like that. And are we going to have evidentiary hearings in every one of those cases?
I think that if there's a way to whittle down the legal issues and knock these claims out on the legal issue, like this case did in Bruce. In the Bruce case that was a predecessor to Taylor, the Bruce court said, wait a second, we don't think that any of these claims, any of these adverse impacts that you're alleging are actually legitimate. We don't think that they affected you in the way that you're saying they did. We don't think that that's sufficient to meet the adverse impact prong. And they dismissed it on at that level.
Well, what about, which would work better? Would it be adverse impact, which starts to sound a bit like it's creeping into the prejudice area, or should we require up front some substantiality to the claim? If there's some winnowing factor, which end should we do it on? Should we do it on both ends?
Both ends being what are the
substantial claim and scrutinizing carefully the effect or prejudice to you of not having, when you analyze the impact on the case of the alleged conflict.
I think to the extent that there was an actual conflict, that's the problem here, is that if we require a prejudice to be shown in all of these cases, then if there were an actual conflict, then that presents a problem. Then you're punishing those people who, when there was
so
an actual conflict and their attorneys.
Right. That's a problem of looking at it at that end, because the prejudice is, in fact, that you didn't have a non-conflicted attorney in the first place.
Right.
And so then should the inquiry be up front, because we have to have some way of figuring out whether this, in fact, evidences a conflict or the ordinary type of strategic decision-making that we let lawyers make.
I think that it's safer to look at the back end. Now, meaning, what is this a legitimate claim? And besides the meat on the bones that I have from the First, Second, Third Circuits and from the Taylor case, I know that it's less than Strickland and certainly more than Anders.
Well, I guess one way to ask the front end versus back end question that Judge Millett is raising is to think about the context in which the asserted conflict is based on the fact that the client hasn't made full payment of the fees that are demanded by the attorney. Because I understand the general state of the law in that context, it's not the case that you can say, well, look, the attorney was asking for money, and therefore he or she had an incentive to cut me short, and I get an evidentiary hearing on the reason that certain claims weren't raised is because I hadn't paid. But it's also not the case that you never can establish an actual conflict in that situation. I assume that what happens is you have to have some kind of direct evidence or something more than the bare assertion that that may have been what motivated it. You have to have some kind of direct evidence that shows, well, the reason that certain claims weren't made was because the attorney was frustrated that he or she wasn't paid. And if you have that kind of direct evidence, maybe you get an evidentiary hearing. So on what Judge Millett is saying, maybe one answer is to have an inquiry along those lines for this context, too, that you have to have something more than just the allegation that the reason a claim wasn't raised on appeal is because of the concern about embarrassment. You have to have some indication that you can point to that shows that that's, in fact, what underlay the failure to make the claim on appeal.
So in this case, what you have is a conceded error. Is it a slip of the tongue, or is it structural?
Whether it's a slip of the tongue or what is of no matter, it is what the jury was instructed. So numerous...
No, but I'm just piggybacking on Judge Srinivasan's point. Why don't you run with that?
In respect to the conflict of interest?
In reflect to finding some cutoff so that the effect isn't either we always have an evidentiary hearing or basically trial counsel will never be appointed appellate counsel. Because, I mean, the Supreme Court's cases about defense counsel winnowing out issues, I mean, you always have cases where, as Judge Millett has been pursuing with you, counsel did not raise certain issues that arguably, A, were legitimate, and B, who knows what a court of appeals might have done. But these are judgments defense counsel routinely make.
Well, I think that in raising these conflict of interest claims, they are going to be piggybacked, in this case, with an ineffective assistance of counsel claim.
What I'm trying to get you to focus on, and maybe you don't want to, and I understand you may not want to, is in this case, you have a claim of a structural error. That's a fairly serious argument, and you have, take the word serious out, that's a serious argument, and you have counsel's admission that he doesn't know how he overlooked it. So, I mean, you've passed some threshold at that point, haven't you?
Oh, absolutely. And, in fact, that's why I wanted to start with Strickland, if only because I do believe that we meet Strickland prejudice in this case, on these facts.
That's what I wondered.
Why argue for a lesser standard when I can meet the full standard?
But to get back to the other question, are you better off or worse off when the lawyer says, whoops, I just missed it? Doesn't that mean the only affirmative direct evidence you have in the record is that it wasn't an active choice between my interests and my client's interests? It was just, whoops.
Well, if you credit the letter, which there's been no cross-examination. The lawyer hasn't been cross-examined. And in the nature of these claims, if you are a trial counsel who is now functioning as appellate counsel, there may be any number of reasons that you just missed, claims that you just missed below and were not focused on because you were trial counsel and you missed them below.
Right. So I guess what I'm asking is would requiring, it sounds like requiring direct evidence up front before we decide who gets an evidentiary hearing would be hard because you're sounding like you need that hearing to get your direct evidence.
I think
you didn't see it because you didn't want to see it.
Well, yes, and I also think so. It would be hard to have direct evidence, a letter saying, I saw that, but I didn't bring it because it would have made me look ineffective. I find that would be a very, very difficult piece of evidence to obtain. So in that sense, that is why I would try to backflip the second.
Of course, that raised all kinds of questions in my mind about what is this hearing going to look like. But why don't we hear from the government and we'll give you...
I'm sorry, can I ask one quick procedural question? I just have one quick procedural question. If you were to prevail, why would the relief be a new trial rather than just a new appeal?
Why would it be a new trial?
Rather than a new appeal. Because you're alleging ineffective assistance on appeal.
Yes, because of the nature of the error. So if this court determines that it's reasonably probable that the Court of Appeals would have found plain error and therefore granted a new trial, it seems like a new trial would be in order. If this court...
Why wouldn't we just go immediately to, which happens with ineffective assistance of counsel, appellate counsel, is you
get a new appeal,
enter a new judgment and do a new appeal.
Understood.
And then we'll let the D.C. Court of Appeals tell us what they would do with this error.
That is possible, but because of the nature of the error, which we don't believe could have been cured in any way, it appears that the trial was infected by this structural error. Also...
But not on the Kyler claim. That may be, whatever you think about the Strickland claim, on the Kyler claim, the problem is that the counsel didn't raise it on appeal.
Right.
So the perfect match for that in terms of a remedy is to get to raise that claim on appeal.
For the Kyler claim, I think if you find Strickland prejudice, I'd also like to say that to the extent any law has changed between when his appeal would have been decided, which it was decided in 1997, and now, if it changed to his detriment, that is also something to consider, because he could be prejudiced by the fact that he's now bringing a direct appeal in a very different legal landscape. I don't know that that's actually the case here, but to that extent, it's something to take into account when deciding whether or not to grant a new appeal or grant a
All
new
right.
trial.
So let us hear from the government.
Good morning. May it please the Court, John Picadez on behalf of the United States. To follow up on your question, Judge Srinivasan and Judge Millett, what we have here is a situation in which there has to be something more than a simple allegation of an actual conflict of interest. And what we have here is, at best, an allegation of a potential or theoretical conflict of interest simply because appellate counsel was also trial counsel. And we have nothing more than that, and it's the...
But that's simply because of that. We have what I think to most people from first-year law on would go, oh, my goodness, if they saw this in a jury instruction. This is the heart of a criminal trial. And you had a you must convict without reasonable doubt instruction. So why isn't the very heft of that claim, the very substantiality of that itself, evidence from one which could make it rightly or wrongly, but at least substantial enough that we need to have a hearing to figure out what happened here?
Well, by the same token, with respect to first-year law students, I think first-year law students and the public at large knows what the standard of proof is, and it's proof beyond a reasonable doubt, and they know that from books and TV shows and movies.
But hang on. When we're reviewing reasonable doubt instructions, and when the judge not only gets it wrong, but says you must, when she directs a verdict, you must convict if reasonable doubt is not proven. We go, oh, come on, juries see enough TV, they know what the real instruction is. We say, a trial by jury has not happened. It's structural. We can't look any further than that. That's a very, so why isn't, but my predicate claim is, why isn't that at least a hefty enough claim?
Well, I would disagree in this particular case that it's a structural error.
I'm not asking, let's assume for purposes of answering this question that we were to conclude that this is this claim would have a substantial likelihood of success. Not certain, but a substantial likelihood of success. Would that be a sufficient sifter up front for culling out which cases get evidentiary hearings and which don't?
I still don't see that it would get an evidentiary hearing if we're talking about a actual conflict of interest context. Mm-hmm. In other words, to determine whether or not the attorney was adversely affected, his representation was adversely affected by an actual conflict of interest.
Well, to decide whether there was an actual conflict and whether to decide both of those inquiries, what is your test then? What is your test in this setting for an unasserted claim? Which ones get evidentiary hearings and which don't?
Well, it's the petitioner's burden to show, number one, that there's an actual conflict, and number two, that it adversely affected the representation of the attorney. So at the very least, the petitioner first has to proffer some sort of direct evidence that there was an actual conflict and more than just simply a potential or theoretical conflict.
Suppose the claim was the judge was biased. He had made a public statement that he knew that 99% of the defendants who were charged were guilty, and these trials, you know, were just a showcase. Is that enough to get a hearing?
I'm not sure what the hearing would be for.
Well, trial counsel failed to bring that up, to object, to seek recusal. It was not raised on appeal. I'm just trying to get you an extreme case to find out where the government draws the line as to getting an evidentiary hearing.
That might be a situation in which, well, that would be a Strickland situation.
I'm trying to get a structural error that maybe the government would agree was structural, namely a biased judge. All right? Would that be enough to get a hearing? It sounds like you're saying it's not.
It may be, because you're talking about whether or not the effectiveness of the attorney. And in that case, in an extreme case, it very well may be that a hearing would be warranted because there was a sufficient allegation in the record.
Well, can I pin that down? A hearing might be appropriate when there's a sufficient allegation in the record. What would constitute a sufficient allegation?
We're talking about a purely Strickland ineffective assistance of counsel issue.
Ethical conflict.
I was just trying to get a structural error claim that you might acknowledge might entitle someone to a hearing. Or is it your position that absent the smoking gun, actual proof up front, there is no basis for an evidentiary hearing? I didn't read your brief that way.
I think maybe I perhaps missed the thrust of the question insofar as it pertains to an actual conflict. I understand the structural error aspect of the question. I understand the attorney failing
counsel
to raise that.
Counsel never objected by moving for recusal of the judge at trial. On direct appeal, counsel never raised the issue of the judge's bias. A motion is filed, basically the same motion as here. Is that enough for an evidentiary hearing? I was just trying to get some substance to your response to Judge Millett's question about what is your test. You don't have to take my hypothetical, but just give us an answer to what is enough for an evidentiary hearing.
The test has to be more than simply an allegation. The test has to be some proffer, some substantive proffer, both with respect to...
So they have a transcript here. As you admit, the judge made the statement. All right? Now, your argument is a slip of the tongue. Your argument goes to the merits of whether or not the other instructions were sufficient, all of those issues. But we have a transcript here. There's no question the judge said this, and it was at the close of the trial where he told the jury to pay attention to what he said. What more is needed?
Well, this is...
Just to get a hearing.
Just to get a hearing. I almost find myself going around chasing my tail and answering these questions as I did when I was writing the brief and as I did when I was preparing for today.
One way to ask the question is, and that, even if you apply Strickland prejudice, the whole point of getting Kyler, I think, is so you avoid Strickland prejudice. I think the hypothetical that's been given to you is a way of asking, at least in some sense, are you suggesting that even if Strickland prejudice is satisfied, that you still don't get a hearing? Because in that context...
No, I'm not suggesting that. There are many cases in which there's an evidentiary hearing to ascertain whether or not there's deficiency and prejudice in the Strickland setting.
In the hypothetical that was given by Judge Rogers, do you think there would be a reasonable probability that the appellate court would have found plain error?
Yes, there's a reasonable probability under that hypothetical, I think, that the appellate court would have found plain error.
Should that be our test?
So Strickland prejudice would be satisfied.
For Strickland prejudice. Right. I don't accept that same outcome in this case.
No, there's a separate question about whether Strickland prejudice is satisfied here. But I guess the question is, why not use Strickland prejudice as the gatekeeper and say that in this kind of context, the test is whether there's a reasonable probability that the plain error argument would have succeeded on appeal. If it does, you get your Kyler claim. If it doesn't, you don't get your Kyler claim.
I think you get the review under Strickland and then getting back eventually perhaps to decide whether or not there was plain error initially, so assuming there was a new appeal. But I think the Kyler question is completely different because you're not going to presume prejudice, as we've argued here, under this set of facts. You don't have...
Right, so you don't... I guess what I'm asking about is a hybrid. So Kyler, the way Kyler has come up to date is that the advantage of getting Kyler treatment is that you avoid Strickland prejudice. The advantage if you're the defendant.
Correct.
Is you avoid Strickland prejudice. But the Supreme Court has never said, and we haven't ever said, that every Kyler claim gets to avoid Strickland prejudice. So then that leaves over the question, is there some Kyler claims as to which you have to prove Strickland prejudice in order to succeed? And maybe this kind of context is one in which Strickland prejudice is the relevant prejudice standard. Now, you still don't have to deal with deficient prejudice under Strickland, so it's not a Strickland claim. The gravamen of the error is still that I had a counsel who was encumbered by a conflict of interest. It's not that I had a counsel who didn't understand the law. It's that I had a counsel who was encumbered by a conflict of interest. But in order to get your claim to go forward, what you have to show is Strickland prejudice. And that would deal, I think, with the kind of hypothetical that Judge Rogers raises.
Yes, and I think that in analyzing along that thread, it's not that far removed from the analysis under the second part of Kyler, which is whether it adversely affected the attorney's representation. It almost seems to have a flavor of Strickland prejudice within that, even though...
It seems pretty different to me, because I think the argument that's made on the other side about adverse effect is, of course there was an adverse effect. The adverse effect was that the claim was never raised on appeal. I have to say that seems pretty logically airtight. That is an adverse effect. The claim was never raised on appeal. But what we want to do is explore whether it makes sense to impose some kind of filter to say, well, it's not just enough that any claim wasn't raised on appeal. There has to have been some substantiality to the claim. And one way to ask the question whether there's substantiality to the claim is to say, well, is it one as to which there's a reasonable probability that had the claim been asserted, it would have prevailed before the state, or in this case, D.C. Appellate Court. In other words, apply Strickland prejudice.
Apply Strickland prejudice. Getting back for a moment, though, to this adverse effect, because the claim wasn't raised on appeal, there is, of course, the claim wasn't raised on appeal, but there's nothing in the record, and it's petitioner's burden to show that the reason that it wasn't raised on the raised as an appellate issue was because of...
Right, I think their point is they need a hearing in order to explore that. How are they supposed to know? They can't get inside the counsel's mind. Point is that the circumstances are such that there's at least a possibility that the reason the counsel didn't raise the claim is because they didn't want their lack of an objection to be laid bare. Now, that seems like that can't happen. It's not. Are you saying it's inconceivable that a counsel would decide not to raise a claim on appeal because he or she was worried about laying bare that they failed to make an obvious objection?
No, it's not inconceivable, but I think that in looking at what we've got here, we actually have something to go by, which is that the petitioner, in support of his petition for a writ of habeas corpus, submitted two letters from his trial and appellate counsel that stated quite clearly, I overlooked this. I didn't see it in the record when I read the transcript.
Well, I know, but that means either you didn't read the transcript or you weren't looking with a very careful eye, right? This is a little hard one to miss.
Well, which then would get it back into perhaps the Strickland realm. But the inference of that is that if I had seen it, I would have raised it.
Now, well, I think again, that's this what they is, want to, I mean, again, it can't be that as soon as the lawyer says, oh, no, it wasn't a conflict, they don't get a hearing. And that seems to be the import of your point, and that can't possibly, because every lawyer is going to write back and say, oh, no, there wasn't a conflict. Can you tell me what is, you mentioned that, you know, clients will get hearings, or clients, defendants will get hearings on a Strickland claim. What is the standard for getting to have a hearing on a Strickland claim? What do they have to show to get to have an evidentiary hearing on a Strickland claim?
Well, typically, they've proffered some affidavits from either an attorney or other witnesses who could attest to why there was some deficiency in the attorney's performance or why it resulted in prejudice. That's typically met by an opposing affidavit from submitted by the government, from the trial attorney, or maybe the appellate attorney in a mandate situation. And then the table is set for the court to hold a hearing. But when,
so to get the hearing, they have to come forward with evidence that says, here was something my lawyer should have done.
It has to be more than conclusory allegations.
But here is something. Imagine we were doing this issue in a Strickland context. They would come forward and say, here is a legal claim. No one disputes it's a viable legal claim. The judge got reasonable doubt wrong. And it happened, no one disputed it happened. No one disputes that it was not raised. It wasn't objected to either at trial or raised on appeal. What more would they say to get to have a hearing on that Strickland claim? Anything? And they would say, and it would have been a different outcome right? They would make that allegation, or they get an expert witness to say it would be a different outcome. What more would they have to do?
Well, on the deficiency prong,
how viable does a claim have to be to get a hearing?
On the deficiency prong, that may be enough if there's affidavits, sworn affidavits, from the defendant, from an attorney. Attorneys have fallen on their swords in the Strickland context, owning up to deficient performance, so that would get them a hearing, and that might even get them relief.
So if this so I guess I'm trying to figure out, let's take Kyler off the table. If they came forward in this case and said, bad reasonable doubt instruction, here's the transcript, here's the case law that says that's bad. Lawyer says, oops, I didn't do it. I didn't see it. Is that enough to get the evidentiary hearing?
Not necessarily, because there's two prongs to Strickland. And one is the deficiency prong, and the other one is prejudice.
Right.
And the courts have typically said that if we can resolve...
But the prejudice seems more a legal question in that context.
Right. And if we can resolve that...
You don't need an evidentiary hearing on that. I mean, it seems to me that sometimes it might be, but in this context, that type of claim...
In this context...
Whereas prejudice is a legal question, not a factual one.
I agree. And in this sometimes
so
there could
be
factual components to it. But in this context, I think you're correct, Judge Millett, it would be a legal question, and you wouldn't need a hearing.
So that showing would be enough to get a hearing on whether or not the law, because I'm sure the government would come back and say, yeah, but you know what? I know why they didn't raise it, because when you look at the instructions as a whole, it wasn't going to matter. And essentially start bleeding into the prejudice inquiry. But would there not be some sort of hearing at that point? It would be a viable enough claim to have a hearing on whether there was...
Not necessarily, because
Strickland land. Why isn't it enough to get into Kyler land?
Well, in Strickland land, the court could decide, look, we don't need to resolve the deficiency prong. Assuming arguendo there was deficiency, the appellant or the petitioner cannot make this case because he cannot prove prejudice under the Strickland standard. Under Kyler...
If it's the other way in the Strickland claim, if you think that in these circumstances there is prejudice and the question is whether there was deficient performance, would you have a hearing on that, or is it this the sort of case in which the deficiency of the performance either is there or is not there based on what we know from the record, which is to say the counsel says, well, I just neglected to do it. Would you actually have a hearing on whether there was deficient performance, or is that something that the court would just assess?
The court at that point may decide that we don't need to resolve that point. We're going to analyze this to ascertain whether there was strict on prejudice.
No, I'm saying that, and I think the question the judge Millett asking is, let's assume that prejudice actually is against the government. Let's assume that the court says, I actually think there probably was prejudice here, so I need to focus on whether there was deficient performance since the defendant needs to prevail on both prongs. Then as to the former prong, is this the kind of context in which you would have a hearing? I'm asking because
that
I don't know.
That probably would be. I could see that there would be a hearing in that context. But on the other hand, if we assume that there's prejudice, it almost goes without saying that the prejudice was caused by something. So... It may be that
you don't need
first question has already been effectively decided. And I think that's perhaps why the courts will evaluate prejudice before, without even necessarily looking at the deficiency prong of Strickland.
Now, let me ask you this. So on the Strickland prejudice question, let's assume we're in Strickland land now and not in Kylo land for a second.
Okay.
If what the judge said was basically what the judge said here, which is on one hand, unless the government proves beyond a reasonable doubt the elements of the offense, the defendant can't be found guilty. On the other hand, and then the judge says still, I'm sorry, guilty, the first part is guilty. On the other hand, still guilty. If that's what the judge said, then would you dispute the notion that there would be Strickland prejudice, or you know, maybe you don't even need to look. Maybe that's just obviously structural error.
I would dispute that it was structural error. I think that this case falls more along the lines.
Even if he says, so what the judge said was, if you find the government has proved beyond a reasonable doubt every element of the offense, it's your duty to find that defendant guilty. That's so far so good. On the other hand, if you find that the government has failed to prove any element of the offense beyond a reasonable doubt, you still must find that defendant guilty.
Well, so you must find that defendant guilty.
No, I know that's what the judge said. I'm inserting still. I grant you that I'm inserting still. I'm asking a hypothetical.
Oh, the hypothetical, if you still. That yeah. would be more of a problem.
I would think so.
The trial court's injecting a word with almost emphasis on that word. I think that hypothetical is more of a problem.
If you engage the hypo, then in that hypothetical situation, it seems like there's a big problem.
More of a problem than we've got here. I think when you look at...
So does your claim rest on your argument rest on the absence of the word still?
The absence of the word still, along with every other instruction that the jury received in this case.
But if he said still, and you still had every other instruction, so I'm assuming everything is the same, except the instruction that's given just includes the word still. If he includes the word still, then it sounds like you can have all the other stuff you want about how the government has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt in order to retain guilt. But once the judge says, you know what, everything I said, you still have to find him guilty, even if the government doesn't prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, there's a big problem there.
I think that's an extreme situation, which is a bigger problem, because the use of the word still seems to reflect back to what the judge just said about the government's met its burden and you find the defendant guilty.
So the government does agree there is something that is structural error. Because I read your brief and I came away thinking there is no such thing as structural error.
Well, there are cases in which there have been problems with instructions, as the petitioner has cited, and there are cases in which words like not have been left out, or the word defendant has been inserted instead of the government, or the preponderance has been used instead of reasonable doubt, which were obvious slips of the tongue in the context of all the other instructions that were given, and the courts have found that did amount to reversible error. And we've cited the Granados case and the Anchetta case and the Tolan case from Massachusetts. And I would submit the following. The cases that...
What about the Supreme Court cases?
Well, Victor v. Nebraska instructs...
And counsel for appellant distinguishes that.
Well, distinguishes it in the sense that we're talking about a faulty... phrasing of a reasonable doubt instruction, an incorrect phrasing of a reasonable doubt instruction, but in the end, it doesn't change the analysis that much, because you're still looking at the overall instructions. What did the jury come away with? Now, the cases...
I think the phrasing at least matters when they're told you must do something, because then it really is a directed verdict. The other ones were different articulations of the standard, or sometimes the verb was may. But are you aware of any case where a jury was told you must convict under the wrong legal standard, you must find guilty under the wrong legal standard, that it wasn't deemed structural? I didn't see that, but you probably looked at more than I have.
Well, then, in Anchetta, it was phrased as the defendant must prove instead of the government. In Granados, It was...
I think it had may in Granados, didn't it?
It omitted the word not.
I think it said you should convict. It didn't say you must convict in Granados. I'm just trying. I'm just curious whether there's one. That's what struck me. I understand that there's the law is very complicated in this area, but the one thing I couldn't find was anything where they... I found ones where they said must, and it was structural error where they, you had something this directed.
Well, I think one of the fundamental...
It was the only time you mentioned what happens if the government doesn't prove its case.
Well, I think one of the fundamental differences in this case is that the jury was repeatedly, time and time again, correctly instructed as to the government's burden of proof. By my count, I think 19 times. They were also instructed at the very beginning of the trial with the correct phrasing of the same instruction that this time included the word not. That correctly
helped. You're not aware of any case where there's been an direction, one like this?
I can't recall offhand right now. But
do you know, by the way, you said in a, I'm sorry, said a footnote in your brief that there was no indication as to whether there were written instructions?
That's correct.
Do we know? I don't know.
I've been unable to find in the portions of the trial file that I've been able to find, I could not find that there were any written instructions. When the judge instructed the jury, the judge did not refer to any written instructions that would go back with the jury.
So what would typically happen? Would the jury get the transcript of the...
What would typically happen was that would be the judge would prepare a script and send the script back, not a transcript of the proceedings.
Do we know what this judge did, what his practice was?
No, I don't.
I mean, judges are very different on this.
Judges are very different, and I think, as I pointed out in our brief, we were really unable to make any headway on this. The judge is deceased. The prosecutor's deceased.
This is a black box as far as we're concerned.
We need a black box.
Yeah. All right.
And the...
Anything further? Okay. Anything further?
No. We'd ask the court to affirm.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for appellant, we'll give you a couple of minutes.
Just quickly, Your Honor, on the... Strickland claim, we do believe on this record that there does not need to be an evidentiary hearing on the Strickland claim because the government accepts the letter from counsel on its face and because as a matter of law, we don't believe that there is any strategic, that anyone can make a strategic decision not to have challenged this structural error in the appeal. There could be no, even if counsel said I made a strategic decision, I think that would have been a deficient decision to have made.
Technical question about how this works.
Yes.
For if you had a, if we had to predict how the D.C. Court of Appeals would have reacted to this, is there a substantial likelihood they would have done something, ruled a certain way? When they ask the question, is there a substantial likelihood it would have had an impact or prejudicial impact on the case, Kyler impact or prejudicial impact in Strickland? Do you actually look at the jurisprudence of the particular court of appeals that's involved, or is it sort of more what would an objective?
No, it is what would the D.C. Court of Appeals have done. Is there a it's a reasonably likelihood, again, which is below preponderance. This standard is not terribly high. That's why I think that we meet it by leaps and bounds.
I'm just curious about this. It's actually the D.C. because you can imagine... You know, that there's a conflict in the circuits, and you would have lost in your circuit, you would have won in another circuit, and you sure should raise it because maybe the Supreme Court is going to take it up, and that would not be enough. I'm just curious about that articulation.
I think because this is this, the focus is on whether or not you would have won in the D.C. Court of Appeals, the focus should be on what the state of the law is in that court. To the extent it, now, this is a constitutional question. So to the extent it conflicts with Supreme Court precedent, no. Then I think that the Supreme Court precedent would trump. But to the extent that the D.C. Court of Appeals has a rule, which it does, that says that if there is structural, then the third prong of the plain error analysis is presumed, then we take that at its face. That's what the rule in the D.C. Court of Appeals
is. So on the question of whether this is structural error, the judge did say, on the other hand, which sends a clue that there's a difference between the two instructions. And how long was the jury out before they returned a verdict?
That's not clear from the record. I am unaware of that.
Oh, I thought there was something in the record that indicated that they were out for at least longer than instantaneously. Because if the jury took the judge's instruction literally, it certainly wouldn't have taken that long to come back with a verdict.
I think that there's two plausible readings of the instruction, such that the jury could have struggled with it and there would still have been a directed verdict. The way that it was written, the first part says that the government has to prove every element of the offense. On the other hand, if the government fails to prove any element of the offense, you must still acquit. That could be interpreted to be, you know, 2 out of 3 ain't bad, 3 out of 4 ain't bad here. When a jury is instructed, they're not assuming and told that they're not to question the wisdom of the law and take these instructions as I give them. They're listening to the instructions and they're trying to make sense out of this. How do we make sense out of these instructions? And I think that that's a possible way for them to have done so. But I also think if they read the instructions as they did,
instead of this scenario, what you had was you had this exact verbatim instruction, and let's even assume that it was the written instruction echoed this and was mm-hmm. given to the jury, so that's what they took back to the jury room. And then you also had another instruction, though, that was correct on this question that was later on. Then wouldn't we at least look at both of those and juxtapose them and try to figure out whether, in the end, the jury was misled?
If there were conflicting instructions. But in this case, there was, while the government points out, and there are several cases that have addressed this and have rejected the government's argument with respect to these types of errors, and I want to talk or just at least cite two of them. But the judge instructed the jury, the government has the burden of proof. The government has the burden of proof. Only one time did it tell the jury what it had to do if the government failed to meet that burden. And the one time it told the jury what to do, it said, you must.
Yeah, I take that point. And I'm not suggesting that the other instructions where the judge kept reaffirming the government's burden is in direct conflict with this one. I'm just making the point that it seems a little artificial to look at this in complete isolation without regard to the overall context.
I think that, well, a couple things. There's the Second Circuit cases discussed this. There was the may versus must convict, may versus must acquit scenario that was addressed in those cases. The Second Circuit said there were 17 times where the court gave the right instruction. And in fact, in Burble, the court specifically said, you cannot find the defendant guilty unless the government had met its burden of proof, which was in direct conflict with the may versus must. And the court said, if there was a curative instruction where it said, hey, wait a second, I acknowledge I gave you the wrong instruction, but you have to pay attention to this one and not this one, then of course, if that were the case here, then there would be no structural error. But that didn't happen. There's no evidence in the record that happened. If there were conflicting instructions, maybe this would be a different case, but it's not. There weren't. And so on this record, to me, it's a very clear structural error. The law presumes that juries follow instructions. Speaking of the focus of the jurisprudence in this area, we're looking at the D.C. Court of Appeals cases. And in Hayward, which is a D.C. Circuit case, but it's precedent because it's from 1969 in the D.C. Court of Appeals, there the court said you must find the defendant guilty if the defendant was present at the time and at the place where the offense charge was committed. So if the government proved beyond a reasonable doubt or disproved the defendant's affirmative defense, you must find the defendant guilty. And that wasn't cured by the other instructions. Baker versus United States, the same thing. If the government does prove to you beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant did not act in self-defense, then you must find the defendant guilty. The court concluded, and I think quite articulately, but the block quotes in our brief, that despite the other instructions, that did not cure this direct command, even though it was at odds with the other instructions.
Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.
Thank you.